I'm Kate Remington. I'm talking with Chris Brubeck, and it is so much fun to finally have a chance to talk with you.
Well, that's the way I feel.
You have got so many incredible projects going on. And first of all, I would love to know about the most recent piece, the world premiere of Pas de Deux, a concerto that you wrote for violinist Jamie Laredo and cellist Sharon Robinson. Working with them must have been such an incredible experience.
It was. As a matter of fact, I was just putting something in the mail to them today, thanking them for the opportunity to collaborate with them. And how that came about is that, as you know, but maybe not all your listeners know, Jamie Laredo is also a conductor. Mm-hmm. So he had conducted the piece I wrote for Sharon Isbin, a guitar concerto called Affinity. And I had sent him a score, and I sent him a note, and I heard nothing from him. It was like crickets. So I thought, oh, he's a famous classical guy, and I'm just a jazz composer guy. I wonder what he's going to be like. And so I went up to Burlington because I happened to be not on tour myself, and I thought, well, I'd like to see Sharon again and see the piece played. And when I met him, it was like, Chris, and a big hugs and all this friendly stuff. It was just totally what I didn't expect, you know, was going to happen. And, I think we went out to dinner that night, and right away he just said, I love this music so much. Would you consider writing a piece for me and my wife, Sharon, a double concerto? And I was like, would I? You know? it'd be fantastic. So the process was that we talked about the piece. They really wanted a tonal piece. I played them and sent them different recordings I had of different other pieces I'd written, particularly things that had to do with strings and violin. And for example, I sent them this violin concerto I wrote for Nick Kendall from the group Time for Three called Spontaneous Combustion. And they heard that and they said, that piece is great. It's got so much energy. We're not looking for something with that much energy. You know, he says, they know everyone because mm-hmm. I saw them as kids and were talented, you know, when they're judges at juries. And Nick is great, but, you know, this is a piece for a 30-year-old wunderkind. Mm-hmm. You know, we're thinking something a little more laid back than that. And then I sent him this and sent him that, you know, whatever. And so I got a feeling for what they really wanted. And, so when I compose, I go down to my, when I say studio, it could be called an office for that matter. There's not that much glorified about it. It's not as beautiful as the WSHU studios which we speak. But I compose directly into the notation program known as Finale. Mm-hmm. And for your listeners that don't know what that means, imagine if you're a playwright, and as you're typing up the play, and let's say, Mr. Mustard said to Mr. Custard, you know, and they would have a different voice. The computer will play back the thing. So if I write a flute part, I will hear a flute play that part back to me, or violin or cello. So I'm building this audio mock-up. Like sometimes I call it the puppet show.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's there's other composers that don't do that at all. But for me, it's wonderful. Because, like, I know when I worked with my dad, sometimes he would say, oh, my God, in the old days, you didn't really know what you had until the first rehearsal. And by then, it's almost too late to do anything about it. You mm-hmm. know, how do you rewrite everyone's parts or cut this or expand that? And, you know, in this way, I get a sense of proportion because I'm hearing it. And it's also great because I can share that. Like I would say to Sharon and Jamie, okay, here's a finale realization of the score I'm working on. You know, what do you think? And I could get their reactions that way before we ever got to the first rehearsal of being on stage.
And what's so cool about that, too, is that they can hear what the orchestra is going to sound like supporting them, too. And, as you mentioned, I'm sure it's easy to tweak things. I've talked with other composers who work in a similar way. But the one thing that they consistently say is, you know, using samples is great. But once the piece gets in the hands of a real live performer, they just bring it to life like exponentially. So.
Right. They really do. And through experience, like I know the difference between when I hear a finale demo and I'm thinking like, that feels good. And I sort of know the X factor of when it leaps up. However, I must say in all honesty that every premiere has its challenges. And in this case, I had gone up to Guilford that you mentioned, because you know Jamie and Sharon too, and gone to a rehearsal at their house with a rehearsal pianist. The orchestra piece actually doesn't have a piano part, but it created, because they're old-fashioned enough, they actually wanted a piano part that they could rehearse with.
Oh, you know? Neat.
And I heard them playing it great, and I was really pleased. Obviously, they'd put a lot of work into the piece, and they knew what was happening. But when we got to the premiere, we were playing it with this great orchestra called Classical Tahoe Orchestra. And that is basically the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, who want to get the heck out of New York City in August. And they go to Tahoe.
Wow.
So it's like unbelievably top-of-the-line musicians. And here was my first rehearsal. I knew they were ready. I thought I'd written a good piece. We're all ready. And the first thing that happens is that they don't have a concert hall. They have a concert tent. And the way the tent is designed is, you know, it's taut material. It's not like a circus tent with a great big pole in the middle. And the back goes down behind the woodwinds in the back of the orchestra. And it's very reflective surface, and it's very close to them, and it curves up and then goes out over the stage. So the highest point in the tent is above where the soloists are. And I'm sitting there listening, and I'm going, oh, my God. Every time I wrote mezzo piano and the flutes, it sounds like someone's blowing in your face as loud as they can. Like, all the dynamics were wrong. And it's not because I was wrong. Mm-hmm. I've written enough pieces.
Sure.
Like, I know when I write for a symphony hall in Boston what that's going to sound like, you know?
Right.
And it's like I called it the atomic woodwind. So I spent the whole time begging these wonderful players. I said, I know you're a fantastic player, and I know I've asked you to take it down from mezzo forte to piano, but it's got to be softer. And then on the other hand, you got the soloists up front, which should be louder because they're 20 yards closer to the audience. Mm-hmm. The sound just goes straight up. And they are just naturally, organically in that environment, not as loud, you know. So, you know, what should have been completely smooth and you're ready for everything was me, after every rehearsal, tastening different things and changing everyone's parts and saying, softer, 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 softer. And the terrible thing about that is we got it really right. It was a great premiere, standing ovation, everyone went nuts. And now I've got a set of parts, and God knows if all those markings are totally wrong for a normal concert hall coming up. So that's just the inside scoop of the challenges. I mean, everything turned out fine, but you just can't take anything for granted.
Well, no, and it's a good thing maybe that you weren't conducting and you were further back to hear what it was going to sound like from the audience's point of view, too.
Oh, absolutely. And the conductor, I'm a great friend with and great faith in. His name is Joel Revson. And going all the way back to the recording I did with the London Symphony Orchestra at Abbey Road Studios, he was the conductor. So we've been friends and mutual fans, you know, for a long, long time. And by the way, I have no interest in being a conductor.
That's why I'm in radio. I thought I wanted to be a conductor.
Oh, well, that's the
thing. It was a lot more challenging than I was expecting it to be.
Well, I'm a Pisces and sort of a sensitive person. So believe me, I've been around the most famous conductors in the world, and I've been around a lot of classical musicians, and everyone ends up, you know, throwing slings and arrows at the conductor, and I don't want to be the target.
No,
I'd rather be the composer they occasionally see and don't like than the conductor they see every day and complain about.
Well, I can't imagine that you get too much feedback about being a composer that no one likes, because your music is so accessible, and it's in a language that is immediately, you know, you really identify with it. You understand it. It's not like composers who write in a minimalist style or something that you feel like you have to have a music degree to understand.
Right, right. Well, I'm glad you feel that way about it. You're my kind of audience. No, but I think what happened is that, like, I've never studied composition or orchestration 1 second in a classroom. And reflectively, my theory is, which I'm sure will offend lots of people, so put on your seatbelt, is that basically in American classical music, sort of in the post-Schoenberg years, and his disciples, who a lot of ended up teaching at major universities, and if you want to study composition, you were getting their ideas of, you know, of 12-tone and serial music and all that kind of stuff. Like, I would have been slaughtered and probably never written a note.
That happened to a lot of composers. They felt like they just couldn't write the kind of music that was really their own voice because there was such pressure to conform and write this really difficult, challenging music.
Right, right. My analogy, which I hope holds up, is like, just imagine you're a designer of chairs. And every generation you thought, I have to change the rules about designing chairs so I can advance. I mean, on paper, that's a wonderful idea. Why sit in this boring four-legged thing? You know, like, and you know, you get Sarin in and different people the right making. But there's a point finally when, in an effort to be different and set new rules so we advance, you come up and you bring up this thing resembling an obelisk, you know, and you say, hey, have a seat. And you say, no, thank you. Well, it's different than everything that went before. It follows these rules. It's beautiful. I can prove on paper, you know, but you sure as hell don't want to sit on it. And I think that we kind of went through this thing where, you know, I mean, it was a joke, but it was true. A lot of times people would look at the composer notes and like, composer born. Oh, he's not dead yet. I think I'm going to hate this piece, you know. Because the modernism. And then I, on the other hand, I always say, thank God for Copland and Bernstein, mm-hmm. who kept some strains of popularism melody going. And the other thing is because I'm a performer. So I know what it's like. I want to have vehicles that you can communicate with an audience with. I just went to a contemporary festival in Switzerland where I heard a really incredibly modern piece. And on a certain level, I was really impressed with the techniques of sound. I was really impressed with the performers who were like Juilliard level kids. But I literally counted, there were three times that I heard something that resembled a triad, an actual chord.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I guess this just proves how old fashioned I am. You know, like, you know, I like to hear melodies and things like that, and I'm rather hopeless. But then, of course, the other part of was it is after the obligatory standing ovation because the composer from Spain was there. And don't get me wrong, on a certain level, it deserved first prize.
Sure.
And it was great in its own way, not necessarily the way that. And I was really proud of the older Swiss audience. You think of Swiss as a pretty uptight, you know, people that would have an obelisk where it belongs, you know, kind of people. They were very polite and gave a standing ovation. But the real surprise was, well, thank you very much. And the conductor says, and therefore, we'd like to play this piece for you again. And they played it twice in the same concert.
Did it sound any better the second time through?
Well, I got to say that there were things I heard the second time through. It was interesting.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was like sort of on a grand scale, like a Spinal Tap moment or something. You know, 20 minutes of completely atonal music and then saying, oh, I'm glad you liked it. Therefore, let's do it again. I've never seen anyone do the thing twice in a concert.
That's incredible. I just and again, you know, sometimes on a second hearing, you like you said, you hear things that you missed the first time through. But I think there is now this kind of wave of composers who are writing music that they want people to listen to and enjoy and not feel like there's this psychological barrier between the music and them. And you've been doing that for years. So.
Yeah, I've just been doing it out of isolation and ignorance. But the pendulum has swung, and now it's okay to write tonal music. And once in a while, I'll get invited to a conservatory or something to talk about music. And I'll ask the teacher, I said, you know, I don't want to, like, step on your toes, but can I talk like this? Is it okay? And it's like, thank God it's okay. I mean, most people really feel that there's a liberation of it.
Yeah.
You know? And also, like, sometimes I work with dancers, too. And it's like choreography. It's like there's some choreographers who really dance with the obvious beat of the music and the accents. Mm-hmm. And that there are some people that religiously never do it. And you just think everyone's lost the whole time. If they're not reacting to the major stretches or the pauses, you know, and it's sort of akin, parallel to with music, you know. If you're trying so hard not to be square that you make it look like that you could be dancing to a completely different piece, then you're hip,
right.
You know. But to me, the obvious answer is that you mix those two worlds together. So sometimes you avoid being right on the beat, and other times you're with it. You know, it's just so logical. And I like in my father's music, he's written some great things that were 12-tone based.
Mm-hmm.
But they, you know, you can, if you're clever, 12-tone stuff can sound pretty tonal.
The
first time he pulled that off was a beautiful setup. He was writing a piece about Jesus Christ, and he used a 12-tone for the 12 disciples.
Oh, wow.
Reciting and announcing their name, you know.
Yeah.
That was in his piece, The Light of the Wilderness. I thought, you know, my dad's pretty smart. That was cool. Harder than hell to sing.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And when he threw in the hardest, weirdest note was Judas Iscariot.
Oh, of course.
Way at the top of his lung in a very stressful way.
Yeah.
It worked.
Well, he studied with Darius Milhaud.
And
that collaboration, or that sort of, I don't know, cross-pollination with ideas and stuff, just did a lot for his music. And so I'm wondering if there are composers that you look to if you're stuck or you just need a little spark of inspiration.
Well, you know, it's funny. I spend so much time writing music that I don't listen to music that much. I mean, I have a lot of music swimming in my subconscious from having the lucky break of going to Interlochen Arts Academy when I was a kid. And we would play 2 hours a day in a different orchestral program with sophisticated stuff every week. So a lot of that stuck in my brain. I mean, sometimes I can even hear a movie score that will inspire me. And of course, your listeners probably know that there was a whole wave of classical composers that, you know, came over from Europe that went to Hollywood.
Yep.
And so all that is going on in our brains in terms of sort of collective musical moments. A lot of stuff I do is so influenced by my dad. Mm-hmm. I usually try to throw in something that's either an inside joke or a little musical cell or something that has to do with my dad in pieces. And I don't think that's plagiarism. That's sort of a little secret homages to him.
Yeah.
And with this idea of writing with the finale notation system, basically I write and then I get tired and then I leave it and maybe I'll go to bed. I'll get up in the morning and I'll say, well, was this any good? You have to be your own editor. You
right.
have to decide,
yeah.
is this crap that I wrote or is this worth pursuing? And then, you know, most of the time it's worth pursuing. And then you do it. And then when you get into orchestration, and then it becomes more like a sculpture.
Mm.
And you're chiseling away at the big piece of the rock and adding this and taking away that. And fortunately, because it's not really pieces of paper, you're not taking away the eraser. You just make a copy of what you did and say, okay, now I'm going to go a different direction for the next 2 hours. What do you think? Have I heard it? Have I helped it? And then you go on. But it takes a lot of time.
Sure.
And you're always fighting the two impulses, which is if you get bogged down in the detail of writing an orchestra piece, then you'll go nuts because you'll miss the forest for the trees.
Mm-hmm.
But so I usually go for the, hey, let's get the forest part. And then I have to go back and clean up all the trees and saw off all the limbs and put all the axes. And then you go crazy because the detail just, you know, it's like being an architect, but you're also drawing every brick in the building, you know.
Sure.
So it can drive you crazy sometimes.
Well, how do you fit all this in? Because you've also written the Concerto for Sharon Isbin that you touched on, Affinity. How do you fit all that in with your unbelievably busy touring schedule?
It's hard.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, and every time you just do a normal human being thing, like hang out with my wife and our grandchildren, whatever, you know, it's also a time that, oh, maybe you should be working, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I've just, you know, just trying to figure out a way to forgive myself for not working, you know, 200% of the time and be a human being. And I'm very fortunate that my wife, Tish, is incredibly helpful to me. She tries to take on as much of the real world crap as possible to help me have time. Because when people say, well, how do you write? The hardest thing, amongst the hardest things, is just to have emptiness. Mm-hmm. You have to have nothingness out of which something can come.
Right, yeah.
In the old days, you know, I could do my thing with my kids and like maybe I'd start writing at midnight and work till 4 and bounce back the next day. But I'm old enough now that I can't quite get away with that. So.
And switching off, I would think, would be a little bit tricky too, because, you know, if you've got, let's say you've left off and you're trying to work out this one melody, and even in even though you're having dinner, it's probably still like in your head sort of floating around. And
oh,
so.
yeah. My wife says that if I'm really in the middle of a piece, I'll be rolling around and sort of thinking music, obviously, in my brain, you know. And she's the unlucky person that witnesses it. Wake up, stop.
Well, are there plans to record the double concerto, the pas de deux?
It's so young in its birth, since it just had the premiere in August, that we haven't planned about that yet. But actually, next week, I'm going down to witness the recording of the Sharon Isbin Guitar Concerto.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So, yeah, oh, I'm really excited about it. It is so hard to get things recorded. And on top of that, as a jazz musician who just spent a lot of time and treasure making a new record, mm-hmm. you also sit there and ask yourself, well, in this day of cultural change where everyone thinks that they should just get music for free all the time, mm-hmm. Even a great, you know, highly praised person like Maria Schneider, I just read an editorial she wrote, like, I don't know if I can do my next project.
Wow.
Because I pay musicians to record, and maybe it takes a $50,000 budget, and I'll just never make it back because I keep getting robbed of how I used to mm-hmm. make my money back
sure.
by the ridiculous royalties that they don't pay. You know, mm-hmm. your listeners might know, you maybe if she had a tune in the radio, maybe it used to translate as, whoa, a whopping nickel.
Uh-huh.
But now the corporate interest out there, like I don't even know, a Pandora, Spotify, mm-hmm. have just decided, oh, we think those artists, that's really worth about 1/100th of one penny.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really making it impossible. Even country Nashville popular songwriters, I mean, they're getting screwed now too. So it gets harder and harder. But like one thing that's very interesting, which ties into the wonderful universe of Nashville Public Radio, is Fred Child's show, The Performance Today.
Mm-hmm.
They had the premiere of the Guitar Concerto, and they played it once, and I thought, oh my God, this is so great. And then I get a notice, oh, we're playing it again. I think they've played it 6 times.
Wow.
Now, if the point is that you write something and you're sharing, you perform something, and you hope people hear it, I think they have 1.5 million listeners.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's 6 shots at 1.5 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So putting out a record is, of course, is wonderful, and maybe they'll buy it. Or maybe they'll go like, well, why should we buy it? We just heard it 6 times, you know. Well, but, you know, you just have to adjust your brain to saying, like I feel whenever I'm writing, if I write something that I think is good, and that's an example when someone thinks it's good. I mean, if it sucked, I don't think that performance would happen 6 times to be played. And I literally, I'll just sit there and I'll say, thank you, God. I mean, I don't know where that came from, the combination of falling out of the sky and talent and hard work, but I'm so glad I was on the receiving end of it. And you just try to make music and keep going.
Yeah, well, sure. And clearly she loves this piece or she wouldn't commit to recording it. So what was it like working with her? I mean, was that, again, because you're a guitarist, and so you probably had a better sense writing for the guitar than you would have maybe for the violin or cello.
You sound just like her because she gave me too much, and you did, credit for being a guitarist. I mean, I can play guitar a little bit, but I never studied classical guitar. Hmm. And even the guitar that I knew, I sort of, my son borrowed my guitar to go to college so he could be like, you know, on the stairs playing, I gave my love a cherry.
Oh, right.
Like John Belushi.
Yep.
I finally got it back from him after about 10 years. So, I mean, I rarely play guitar. It gave me some sense. But I got to tell you, another NPR plug. Mm-hmm. I was actually on my way to do a jazz gig, and I was listening to public radio, and they were interviewing some other composer who was talking very candidly with his interviewer about how he had been commissioned to write a guitar concerto, and he had writer's block, and he kept worrying about he didn't play guitar, and he kept wondering what was possible and everything. And then he said, a musical friend of his said, hey, remember, this guitarist hired you because they heard the music that you write, and they think they like the way you think musically. So don't worry about if you can play it or not play it. Worry about just making the music. Let her figure out if it's playable or not. And if it isn't playable, I'm sure you'll hear about it.
Wow.
But those words were liberating to this particular composer. So luckily for me, I heard that broadcast. And so I said, hey, I'm going to learn from this guy right away. So I didn't think too much about how playable was it or wasn't it. And just I just went for it, and I had times where I'd go into New York, and we'd go into Sharon's apartment, and we'd go through it. And she would say to me occasionally, I would say maybe like 5% of the time, she would say, this is literally impossible to play.
Hmm.
And I said, well, okay, then let's change it.
Right, yeah.
But the good news was, you know, when you have like 90% of it isn't impossible to play, and then you say, let's go for it. And in her hands, I mean, I trust her and her track record and everything. So it was great to work for her. But even working with her, there is actually an interesting story about, it's not a three-movement work. It's one solid piece. There's something very interesting happened with sort of the slow part, which would traditionally be kind of the middle movement. It's, she loved the beginning, and she super loved the ending. And as kindly as you can say, I don't think she was as in love with the middle part. And so we were talking about this and talking about that. And she said, well, I know that your father passed away, you know, recently. And I'm just curious if there's anything that he ever wrote that you thought would be a thematic inspiration that you think is very guitaristic. And at the time, I was actually at my father's house. To get away from my house, there was some construction work going on. And I was looking out through this giant window onto some trees and a little river. And I was saying, oh, that's Sharon. Well, that's an interesting idea. And then right when I said that, it was about it was in October, all of a sudden an orange leaf broke off and started spinning around slowly and falling into the water. At the same time, I was simultaneously thinking of this beautiful tune he had written called Autumn.
In her tune. Yeah.
And so I thought, oh my God, that is so guitaristic. Mm-hmm. And so within a day and a half, I had replaced the middle using that theme and sent a sound file to Sharon. And she said, I adore this. Now I love the piece from top to bottom.
Wow.
This is so cool. You know, and I had to make some, you know, different changes to the piece, but that was the essence of it.
Wow.
And it always gets people. It's so tonal and pretty. You know?
Yeah. And really heartfelt too.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. What else have you got kind of coming up in your headlights right now that you'd like to talk about?
The next piece I think I'm going to be writing is a big commission from a festival in Switzerland.
Hmm.
And they want me to write a big choral piece.
Oh, wow. Is that a first for you?
It's not a complete first, but I generally don't write for chorus that much. And I've had the honor of hearing many of my dad's choral works.
Mm-hmm. They're beautiful, by the way.
Oh, yeah. They really are.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's like that whenever I write a piece, it's kind of weird because usually before you start a piece, you go through a rather businessy negotiation,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you got to figure out, you know, are you going to get paid? Who's going to pay you? How much are they going to pay you? When is it due? When are the deadline moments? You know, and then when it's over, you just sort of like pop the champagne cork. Yes, I have a new commission. And my wife's all excited. I said, yeah, now there's one little detail. I have to write the damn thing.
You know? It's
like, and then it's hanging over your head. You know, it's like the Edgar Allan Poe thing.
Mm-hmm.
As time marches on. But, you know, after a while, you just get faith. I mean, every time I write a new piece, I figure out, what am I doing? Have I gotten in over my head? And you jump off the cliff and you pray and then you hope your wings come and you're not pulling an Icarus.
Do you find that having maybe a couple years to work on a piece is almost like too much time? And it'd be easier if you had a really short amount of time to turn it around?
Well, it depends. I mean, I do believe that nothing would ever get done unless you had a deadline.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to set realistic deadlines. And they also try to, you know, set them in such a way that I think I have a reputation for meeting my deadlines. There are other composers I know that are wonderful composers, but they've missed it by year. And then they missed it by the next year. And, you know, that kind of stuff can happen.
Mm-hmm.
I've also found out, like, if you look at your calendar and say, oh, I'm on tour from here to here and I've toured to there, hey, it looks like I have 3 months at home. I can almost guarantee you that real life will interfere and half of your time when you thought you could be writing will disappear.
Hmm.
That I've learned the hard way over the years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard. I guess I'd, you know, 2 years off is a long ways, so I'd rather get on it. Another thing I'm going to be working on soon is that my father's 100th anniversary. He was born in 1920.
Oh, my gosh. That's so cool.
It's coming up. So we are trying to figure out ways of encouraging orchestras to remember Dave's music and to play it and mm-hmm. to celebrate it. And in a way, that's sort of the worst pressure I've ever faced in my life mm-hmm. is just trying to get people, because the orchestra world books a year and a half, 2 years in advance. And by the way, they're all very occupied with Bernstein right
now. Well, sure,
now.
But that's this year. So.
That's this year. Right, and it's very befitting since since Bernstein and Brubeck collaborated mm-hmm. and were real pioneers in that kind of thing of bringing jazz and classical together.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've thought was probably a good idea was to work, and it's also going to be this 60th anniversary of Time Out coming up. So it was to create a new orchestral arrangement, we're going to call the Time Out Suite, where you get everything put together. And if it's a smaller orchestra that can't afford to hire a jazz group or they can't get together with the chorus, but you know, they could do that maybe.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, so that's another timeline thing.
Very cool. Well, Chris, it has just been so much fun talking with you. It's hard
fun
to keep up
with
all
you
your
too.
Stuff, but hopefully we'll have a chance to do it again when you're back in town for just a little window
yeah,
of time.
Yeah, well, hopefully we make a tradition every time a recording manages to eke out.
That'd be awesome. Well, yeah. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.